Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Don't look now, but yes, that is another big banking scandal we've got. Remind me, how does that saying go? The more things change? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 12th of November. Great to have you with us, as always, everybody. Remember that guy who famously robbed the bank because that's where the money was, right? Well, if anybody knows where the money is, it's the big banks. And some of the biggest banks today agreed to pay fines totaling $4.3 billion for manipulating the foreign exchange markets. Regulators say that over a five-year period, starting back in 2008, UBS, JP Morgan Chase, and Citigroup, among others, conspired to get rich at the expense of their clients. They did their business, apparently, on Bloomberg terminals and on social media, so we know how they did what they are alleged to have done. We even know, if you can believe it, the names they called themselves.
The Dream Team.
The Cartel.
One Team, One Dream.
The Club.
The Bandits Club.
The Bandits Club. Marketplace's David Gura explains how it all went down.
In terms of the amount of money that changes hands, foreign exchange is the biggest market in the world by far.
Easily 10 or 20 or 30 times bigger than any other single market you could imagine.
Carol Osler is a finance professor at Brandeis, and she says more than $5 trillion moves through the market every day.
Trading is literally 24, almost 7. Over the weekends, very little happens, but there's trading almost any time you want to trade.
Companies trade currencies to import and export products, to buy and sell bonds. Banks want to be sure they've got enough yen or euros to buy or sell something at a moment's notice. Because currency trading happens all the time, there's no closing price.
So there was a need for some sort of formal price that institutions could use to value their portfolios.
And so the fix was born.
BBC News at 4 o'clock.
They had to find an arbitrary time to grab off a rate, and they just decided to do it at 4 p.m.
Catherine Dominguez teaches economics at the University of Michigan. Every day for 1 minute around 4 o'clock London time, Reuters takes the average exchange rate, and that becomes the fix. Daryl Duffy at Stanford's Graduate School of Business says that if you're buying and selling currencies, well, sometimes you do it in real time.
But sometimes you tell the bank, well, never mind giving me a price now. I'll just pay whatever the 4 p.m. fixing price is.
And because of that, currency dealers had an easy time colluding to drive that price up or down. Brandeis's Carol Osler says they told each other in private chat rooms how much they had to buy and sell to move the price.
The dealers are thinking, well, gosh, if almost all of us are going to be buying, then we know the price is going to go up. Well, it would be really helpful to know what is going on with everybody else.
When they announced the fines, regulators called on banks to change their corporate culture, and they left the door open for criminal prosecution. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
As David said, they did a lot of their business, these folks did, by means that have now become public, so we know exactly what they said. Herewith, then, a dramatic reading of some of their actual text messages, courtesy of the Marketplace players.
Clearing the decks.
I got the bookies covered.
You getting Betty on the mumble still?
We were epic at the WMR fix yesterday.
Will he tell the rest of the desk stuff?
Or God forbid his New York office?
That's a really important question.
Don't want other numpties in the market to know.
Is he going
to
protect us like we protect each other against our own branches? How can I make free money with no heads up?
Get it up to 60, 70, then bash the out of it.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, baby.
Nice work, gent. I don my hat.
Yeah, so... Anyway, climate change. China and the U.S. have, as you know, reached a landmark deal on global warming, committing both countries to big reductions in greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade. Lots has been said about how big a deal it is that there is a deal at all, and it is. What hasn't been talked about quite as much is what a big undertaking we are looking at, dialing back emissions to, say, 75% of what they were in 2005. How is that going to happen? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Here's the secret. These are reductions the Obama administration has basically already committed to. Ethan Zindler is an analyst with Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
If you're in the clean energy industry in the U.S. and you've been keeping up on these developments already, then this announcement probably doesn't represent a major game change for you.
If you're not in the clean energy industry, you may wonder what developments Zindler is talking about. One will be familiar. The Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Power Plan, proposed in June, is designed to decrease emissions from existing power plants, and that's big. A less well-known rule, still getting finalized, would strictly limit emissions from any new power plants. So old-style coal plants, the biggest emitters, effectively, new ones would be forbidden. Then there's a rule that's already in force, fuel efficiency standards for cars.
The average car that's sold, you know, this month is about 25% more fuel efficient than the one that was sold in the U.S. about 5 years ago.
The power plant rules are still proposals, and a new president could eventually undo them. But this agreement makes the whole framework a little stronger. Dan Bacall watches the electric power sector for the nonprofit group Ceres.
Anytime two major leaders, reach an agreement, it has some level of authority to it.
And the diplomatic partnership opens the door wider to cooperating on the how. Sue Tierney is an energy consultant with the Analysis Group.
There will continue to be really advanced technologies that we will cooperate on together. We need to figure out how to deal with the carbon emissions associated with coal.
Technology for cleaning up emissions from coal generators is experimental and costly. Tierney thinks teaming up with China could help. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, much sound, much fury, not signifying a whole bunch. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've done a lot of stories on this program about big data, how our every like or consumer dislike can be tracked and tallied, usually for somebody's profit. We've done data stories most recently about our kids, about all the ways that schools and states are gathering data on what students do every day. Today, we're going to look at how schools are putting some of that data to use. They're using it, really, to predict the future. From Learning Curve, our project on education and technology, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Right next to the desk of Principal Kelly Birch at Willis Jepson Middle School in Vacaville, California, is a whiteboard with the names of all the kids in the school who are struggling, the kids who might not finish high school.
So right now we have about 56 students up here on the board that are considered high risk.
And next to each name, the reasons why: academics, attendance, discipline.
It's a great visual for me. When I see that board, I have an urgency that these kids need something now.
Birch says in the past, getting a full view of which kids were in trouble took time. A teacher might notice a problem, maybe mention something to the counselor.
And then the counselor would look into them and the counselor would say, oh, they're not doing very well. But by then, it's a quarter into the school year, a semester into the school year.
Now, Birch has what's called an early warning system. Her team gathers and processes a steady stream of student data, GPA, attendance, demerits, test scores, and that data, it lets them peer into the future and spot the 7th and 8th graders who may be headed for trouble.
It's about using data that are available to predict which students may be at risk, identify them, and then actually provide supports and interventions to those students so that they get back on track.
Susan Bowles-Terrio studies early warning systems at the American Institutes for Research. She says the proliferation of student data out there has made these systems possible, even common.
There are probably schools and districts in every single state across the nation that are using early warning systems in some format.
In Wisconsin, for example, every sixth grader in the whole state is given a score of 1 to 100 that represents that child's chances of finishing high school on time. Kids who are under 78.5 are red flagged as high risk in the state's student database.
It's early, and that's the real advantage of it.
Jared Knowles is a research analyst at the Wisconsin Department of Instruction. His office is the one that calculates the scores. He says predicting the path of a sixth grader gives teachers a chance to change that path. It can be cheaper to intervene early, before problems multiply. But Knowles acknowledges using data this way, labeling kids like this, has risks.
We do a lot of work to communicate about the limits of the prediction, that it's not destiny.
You don't want a teacher to see a kid with a score of 20 and give up on that kid in order to help all the 80s. And you don't want a kid to find out the score and give up on herself. The data, says Knowles, is just a snapshot of how a child's doing. But it's not a diagnosis, and it's not a cure.
The school really has to do the hard work to re-engage them back into the educational system.
And these interventions take a lot of forms, everything from special ed evaluations to behavioral counseling to mentoring to this English class back at Principal Birch's Middle School in Vacaville.
This is our English intervention.
A teacher works with about a dozen middle schoolers.
The reason why you're in here is because it appears that you are struggling with reading.
Wedging these classes into the school day took some pretty elaborate scheduling, and Birch made some classes a little bigger to free up teachers to run these interventions. But Birch says it's worth it to get kids back on track for that day when the counselor comes into her office.
And she'll say, okay, you know, we're going to take these names off the list, and I review the list, and then we do a little dance while we're standing in here erasing their names.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Not every state uses data and early warning systems to spot kids who might be headed for trouble. There is a map where you can see if your state does. You can check it out at marketplace.org. Today's lesson in the voracious appetite that capitalism has for profit comes in the form of a Twinkie and of its parent company, Hostess. You'll recall the wailing and gnashing of teeth a couple of years ago when the company's assets were bought by a private equity firm. Children and, yes, adults everywhere really bemoaned the tragedy of lost sugary snacks. Well, not only is Hostess back in business, but 2 years after the company was taken private, its value has reportedly tripled. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explores how that happened.
Hostess's owners, Apollo Global Management and Metropolis & Co., bought the company for $410 million almost 2 years ago. Today, there's speculation it's worth almost $2 billion. How did they do it? I asked David Robinson, who teaches finance at Duke University.
They buy the company's assets, and then they start looking for inefficiencies.
In the case of Hostess, that meant outsourcing delivery of Twinkies and Ding Dongs, slashing the labor force, and closing some plants. But the private equity buyers also capitalized on nostalgia for Hostess snacks and the panic that they would soon disappear. Their social media campaign featured stars like Snoop Dogg tweeting about a special delivery of Twinkies. Even Wall Street analysts weren't immune.
I am a ding-dong man.
Bruce Cohen is a senior partner at Kurt Salmon. He did some panic buying for his office.
We went on Amazon and we bought Twinkies and ding-dongs and the apple pies and the small donuts, and we had a big celebration.
Now that Hostess's value appears to be soaring, other private equity firms are trying the same thing. According to Peter Cowan, managing director of Clear Capital Advisors, he's a private equity investor and advisor.
Just because a company is financially a wreck, it doesn't mean that there's not a loyalty and people in stores want the product and it brings a certain joy and a deliciousness.
Cohen says there are other examples of money being made from nostalgia. Just look at the turnarounds of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer and Old Spice cologne. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, Amy Poehler offers a little advice.
Your career is like a bad boyfriend. Your career will never call you back. It flirts openly with other people.
Our conversation live on stage with Amy Poehler and Norman Lear straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off a fraction of 1% today. We'll call it 2 points, closed at 17,612. The NASDAQ up 0.3%. That is 14 points, 46.75 at the bell. The S&P 500 dipped less than 0.1%. That's a single point, ended things at 2,038. Those big bank fines we told you about sent financials down. JPMorgan Chase withdrew 1.33%. Citigroup gave back 0.7% today. Tech stocks had a better day. Twitter rose more than 7% after telling analysts it had plans to make the social network easier to use. But seriously, how hard is it? Apple clicked up 1.4% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.37%. I mean, come on, it's only 140 characters, right? You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases weekly jobless claims. Major League Baseball announces both National and American League MVP award winners. And go out and give a compliment, or a hug, or maybe just a high five. It's World Kindness Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know the internet, right? Those addresses you type into your browser that get you to one page or another. Well, this is kind of a funny way to think about those addresses, but they are, in a very real sense, a business opportunity. Not only for companies which are buying up what are called top-level domains, the bits after the dot, like .eat or .tech or .whatever. They are also opportunities for the organization that is selling those domains. Nova Sappho explains.
Those .coms and .orgs at the end of web addresses are actually where the internet begins.
And what they really are functionally are lists.
Jonathan Citrain is a professor of law and computer science at Harvard.
So if I want to find something like marketplace.org, I'm going to visit whoever holds the list of .orgs and say, hey, I'm looking for Marketplace.
At the top of the domain name food chain is ICANN, the Internet Corporation of Assigned Names and Numbers. ICANN licenses a variety of .whatevers, which get sold to you and me as website names. The nonprofit took in $80 million last year, and it has started a major expansion of the amount of .whatevers. That's led to an online land grab, says Blair Henley Frank. He's a correspondent for GeekWire.com.
The companies that are able to monetize and sell this new property that they're picking up have the potential to make a lot of money.
That may be why Amazon was willing to spend $4.5 million to purchase .buy. One of the other companies in the game is Rightside. CEO Taryn Naidu says they've applied to own .army, Navy, Air Force, .democrat, and Republican.
Right now, I mean, user awareness is at the lowest it will ever be. So we're pretty excited about what the opportunity is ahead of us. You know, the most transformative thing to happen to the internet in the last 10, 15 years.
Transformative and lucrative. ICANN alone expects to make $20 million this year just from the new .whatevers. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
We wrapped up our roadshow season this past weekend, the live shows we've been doing called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. We did something a little bit different to close things out. A couple of conversations about the business of creativity with two people from the world of television. Television comedy, to be more specific. Norman Lear has been around TV almost since TV as we know it has been around. You know him best probably as the creator of All in the Family. He is 92 years old. He has spent the last six of those years writing his memoir. It's called Even This, I Get to Experience. If you have watched comedy on television at almost any point in the past 13 years, you know Amy Poehler from Saturday Night Live and Parks and Rec on NBC for the past 7 years. Her new book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It is called Yes, Please. And I asked her as we got going how she handles the stress that working and family and everyday life can bring and still be so creative. Here's what she said.
In the book, I write very briefly about the difference between career and creativity, because creativity is loving your work, and creativity is like a warm, I picture it like a Hispanic woman who makes delicious food for me. And I don't know why, I just think she's Latina. And then she smells great, and she hugs me all the time, and she tells me I'm beautiful, and she makes me laugh, and she has a really young son that I get along with. And your career is like a bad boyfriend. Your career will never call you back. It flirts openly with other people. It's never gonna marry you. It likes it when you ignore it. And those two things are very separate.
You both talk a lot about where you came from, about your upbringing. You talk a lot about your dad, who was an interesting guy. Who was taken away when you were nine for 3 years and came back. You talk about life in Newton, Massachusetts. I wonder how you think that influences what you do or did creatively in your profession.
I grew up with my parents were public school teachers, and I didn't know anybody who was an actor or writer. So For me, growing up in a very well-protected and loving, supportive, lower-middle-class home, very blue-collar home, it was a nice mixture of my parents kind of telling me you can be whoever you want, but also a expectation that you have to work hard all the time. Yeah. So everybody worked really hard, and no one really had any money. And, you know, it was that thing when no one really has any money, everybody knows how much money everybody makes.
Right.
Everybody knows how much money everybody has in the bank. Everybody talked about money all the time. It was like, how much did you pay for that refrigerator? How much is that car? What'd you get for that? The constant soundtrack of money. And you can either decide to have a bad or good relationship with money moving forward.
That was the biggest topic of conversation.
Yeah, for sure.
What could we, afford?
Yeah. Certainly in your house, yeah, growing up in the Depression. Yeah, absolutely. Archie Bunker, you have said, bears no small resemblance to your dad.
Mm-hmm.
True?
In the sense that my dad called me the laziest white kid he ever met. And I would yell at him that he was putting down a whole race of people to call his son lazy, and he would say, that's not what I'm doing, and you're the dumbest white kid I ever met. So I grew up with that. And the endless volume, did you?
Yelling?
Screaming, yes.
No, not crazy yelling, no.
When they got together, when the families got together at Thanksgiving or something, that the fact that Gert didn't invite Edna to the wedding 27 years ago, I mean, that kind of argument should have carried on for.
Your dad actually used to tell your mother to stifle, right? Just like Archie Bunker?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Jeanette, stifle yourself.
Yeah. This marks a moment in time for you, right? Parks and Rec is ending. You've got your book out. I'm sure you're going to do something else. Norman, in 1977, you basically said to all those 5-6 shows you're running, I'm done. Got to do something else with my life. How does it affect you in the present tense? And how were you thinking about the next creative thing you would do?
I'm very excited. Because I feel really fulfilled by what I've got to do these past couple of years. This chunk of 7 and 8 years has been really exciting. I'm so much more ready for it than I was when I was younger. It's such a joy to get older.
Ooh,
and
say that
be
again.
It is. It's just you know yourself better. You know, you don't take things so personally. You have these just unbelievably emulsified friends. And
I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
Emulsification is when
I
you...
Yeah, I know that.
Oh.
that I got. I can make a mayonnaise.
Have you heard of science?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't put my friends in blenders, though.
Emulsified friends meaning flavorful, juicy peers who are just, like, so concentrated. You know, it's like the reason why, you know, you have 10 bridesmaids when you're 25.
Yeah.
Yep. You just
and now you're in touch
with one. You just don't when you're 45.
Yeah.
You just don't. You've gotten it together.
You were, Norman, in retrospect, a young man when you stopped doing television full time. You were like 57 or something.
I guess.
Well, so we'll go over it. It was 1977. You were
I don't feel that much older right now. That's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how recently I've been surprised by who I am. I was in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and it was a book fest.
Yeah.
So there were 7 of us on the stage, sitting, waiting to be introduced, and we all read something from our books. And the fellow who was introducing us was introducing the 7 authors on the stage to his right, and he named them, and he used the word author about 7 times, 10 times. And I've been a writer all my life. And now this guy is calling me an author. And I swear to God, I'm feeling more mature.
Ladies and gentlemen, the author Norman Lear and the author Amy Poehler. Thank you guys so much for your time. That is, of course, just a slice of what we talked about. Our whole conversation with Amy and Norman went 38 minutes. We're going to push it out on our podcast today. If you're already a subscriber,
Well, thank you very much. If you're not, go sign up at marketplace.org. While you're there, there are pictures and interviews from all of our roadshows.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which I will freely admit in advance, I am cribbing from my colleague David Brancaccio in the Marketplace Morning Report, but it is too good to pass up. You know how we are just now emerging from the long national nightmare that is the Starbucks pumpkin spice latte? Well, the chestnut praline latte debuted today. I figure, personally, might as well just get ice cream, right? All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow off a fraction of 1%, about 2 points. NASDAQ up 0.75%, 14 points. The S&P 500 off less than a 10%. That is one single solitary point. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.